is the Brett Winterville Show. AM 760 Talk and Breaking News. So it is Tuesday, and coming up here later in the week, we will be entering into the holiest days in the Christian calendar, right? Because you're going to have Easter this Sunday, and running up into that, you'll have Holy Thursday, Good Friday, Saturday, and then into Easter Sunday. And I wanted to bring in somebody who's going to be very busy this week, and I wanted to bring him in for a visit. My good friend, Father Bill Nicholas from the Archdiocese of L.A. To kind of touch base about the events coming up here in these next couple of these next 4 days. Father, how are you?
Doing good, Brad. Good to be with you again.
It's good to have you here. I know this is an unbelievably busy time for
Tell me about it.
Over at your church. It's a good thing we went an extra hour later tonight than we, you know, we were doing this extra hour. I've got another opportunity to get with you here. When it's busy. So let me ask you this question, and so I'm going to just come at it from the perspective of somebody who may or may not be totally familiar with all of the story of Christ. Okay,
right.
What is the birth of the Christian church? Some would say it's Christmas. Some would say it's Easter. What do you say?
Well, actually, the teaching of the Catholic Church is that the church was born from the side of Christ as he hung upon the cross. And when the soldier thrust the lance into him, as it is told in the Gospel of John, blood and water flowed forth, and they see that as the dual symbols of the sacraments of baptism, whereby the Christian is brought into the church in the very beginning, and the sacrament of Holy Eucharist, in which, you know, we partake of the body and blood of Christ. And so many people would say that the Feast of Pentecost, which is the feast 50 days after Easter, is the birthday of the church. But I always like to say, you know, that the church's teaching is that it was born from the side of Christ, so it would be Good Friday, and Pentecost would be the day that the champagne bottle got smashed against the hull and the church was launched on the world. So the church was born on Good Friday as Christ hung on the cross.
Which is what's so interesting, I think, for so many people who would look at this. They would say, wait a minute, that is the darkest, saddest moment in the entire narrative, right? That is the moment at which Christ is dying. And that is the lowest part of the calendar, wouldn't it? I think that's what the objection people would have.
Well, that depends on who you talk to. It's a pivotal moment. All four of the Gospels, of course, have it, and where three of them, the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, will present more of the passion of Jesus, and we read from those Gospels on Palm Sunday, which was, Tuesday. It was last Sunday as part of the Gospel reading for that Sunday's Mass, and if those tend to focus on the suffering Jesus and the sacrifice on the cross. The Gospel of John, however, which is actually read every year in the liturgy on Good Friday, John presents it very much as a glorification. It's a part of John's gospel that's called the Book of Glory, and he presents it very differently. I mean, for example, Simon of Cyrene doesn't carry the cross for Jesus. Jesus carries it himself in his own steam. He does things from the cross to fulfill Scripture. It says in the gospel, to fulfill the Scripture, he said, I thirst. When things were finished, he said, is it accomplished, and he died. He's very much in command. He's very much doing the Father's will in John's gospel. He doesn't say, let this cup pass from me. He reprimands Peter for cutting off the servant's ears. He says, am I not to drink the cup that my Father has given me? Jesus is determined that this should happen. And throughout the Gospel of John, he says, when I am lifted up from the earth, it's something he's looking toward, he's moving toward. And the Gospel of John presents it, theologically at least, as a very, very much a glorification, almost like the entire trial of Jesus, where he's not silent, but he answers Pontius Pilate's questions. You have almost, an interrogation, a robing and a crowning, albeit of thorns, a presentation to a crowd on a judgment seat called Gabbatha, which was a seat of judgment, when he presents him to the crowds, to his enthronement on the cross, where he conducts unfinished business before he dies. It's very much a coronation ceremony for the King of Glory, as John's gospel presents it, and that's the gospel we read every year on a Friday that's not Tragedy Friday or even Passion Friday. It's called Good Friday, because the focus is very much on the glorification of Christ on the cross.
In terms of the parts of the narrative that people will tend to focus on, right? So you have Judas betraying Christ. You have the choice by the crowd to call out, give us Barabbas, right? To be released. Are those things that were fated to happen, for lack of a better word, right? Does Judas actually have free will up to that moment? Did the crowds actually have free will at the moment that they yell, "Give us Barabbas"? What is the takeaway on those two events?
Well, the question so much of free will isn't brought into play so much, but that what transpires mm-hmm. is a fulfillment of what the prophets had mm-hmm. foretold. Not so much predicted the future, but their prophecy that God would come in and save his people, Israel, and through Israel, redeem the world. Just what has transpired, obviously by the free will of everyone there,
right.
But what has transpired was a fulfillment of what had been promised by God to his people, Israel.
When you look at the end point of the crucifixion itself, the time at which Christ dies, mm-hmm. and he's taken down from the cross, the one very interesting consistent story is that across all four of the Gospels, Joseph of Arimathea appears in all of them
right.
and says, "Give me his body. I want to take his body. I want to put him in the tomb." There are subtle differences between the Gospels throughout the whole narrative, right? But there are some that are absolutely universal and across all four of the Gospels, right?
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, he dies on the cross. There were two crucified with him.
Right.
Joseph of Arimathea asked for his body. A centurion, at least three of them, does make a comment, "Truly this man was the Son of God."
Mm-hmm.
The reasons he says it vary. And in the Gospel of Luke, he doesn't say, "Truly this man was the Son of God." He said, "Truly this was an innocent man." And interestingly enough on that, in the Gospel of Luke, only two declare Jesus innocent. The centurion, when he says, "Truly this was an innocent man," and first before him, Pontius Pilate, when he says, "I'm not responsible for the blood of this innocent man." And so it's interesting that it was two Romans who declared Jesus innocent in the Gospel of Luke. But again, those are subtle, among the subtle differences you see. But yeah, there are consistencies of all of them. He was crucified outside of Jerusalem. Under Pontius Pilate, by the insistence of the religious leaders. And Joseph of Arimathea is one of those.
One of the other interesting things to me is people oftentimes will, as ways of poking at the church, right, will say, "Oh, mm-hmm. you hold women secondary. Women are secondary. Women are not that important." Yet in the Gospel of John, at the time of the crucifixion, you have present John at the foot of the cross and Mary and his mother Mary, right? I mean, they're there.
I always like to make a distinction on this. When you look at Matthew, Mark, and Luke, he's completely alone.
Mm-hmm.
The closest people there are standing at who are associates of his, are standing at a distance. Too afraid to get close. It's again returning to the Gospel of John. It's only the Gospel of John that we see, and the way the Gospel puts it is his mother mm-hmm. and his beloved disciple, the disciple whom he loved. Now, of course, thanks to the other Gospels, we know who his mother is.
Right.
But if we only had the Gospel of John to go on, we would not know the name of his mother. She appears in only two occasions, the wedding at Cana
mm-hmm.
and the crucifixion in the Gospel of John. And in both of those occasions, it refers to the mother of Jesus was present. The mother of Jesus said, "They have no wine." The mother of Jesus said, "Do whatever he tells you." And from the cross, Jesus saw his mother with the disciple whom he loved. And so in many ways, she kind of transcends her role as Mary to representative of many things. And again, one of the unfinished business he conducts from the cross is in many ways to identify the mother as a symbol of the church, because we honor her as Catholics as the model disciple of Christ and therefore symbol of all disciples and therefore a symbol of the church. And he takes the church and puts it into the care of the beloved disciples. So the church is now put into the care of the disciples, which is where we see the church down to today. That's the disciples who care for the church. It is followers of Christ, sinful, but still inspired by God and guiding the people of God and sanctifying the world. So it's interesting where many people will say Mary and John, and I don't belabor it, but when you really look at the Gospel of John, it says his mother and the beloved disciple, never identified. And even there you see the King of Glory reigning from the throne, conducting unfinished business and leaving the church born from his side in that way with the spear thrust, but also placing another symbol of the church in the mother, that perfect disciple, into the care of the disciples symbolized in the beloved disciple. So in many ways, it's a royal and very symbolic gesture that he conducts from the cross.
Okay, a final question, because we know what happens on Friday, and we obviously know what happens on Sunday,
mm-hmm.
which is the celebration of the resurrection, right? The resurrection happens. Now, this requires, I don't know, speculation on your part, or maybe you have an insight. People will say, well, what happens on Saturday? What's going on Saturday? When all this is, you know what's going on Friday? You know what's going on Thursday night, Friday? Sunday. What's happening on Saturday?
What's happening on Saturday? Well, remember what the scriptures say, that it was sundown when he came down from the cross, and the next day was the Sabbath, a day of rest. Nothing's happening. Or if you could say, creation is holding its breath now.
Yeah.
Christ is in the tomb, he's died, and creation is awaiting that last moment, that resurrection, because you can't have the resurrection without the death of Christ. There's a great line in the movie Cleopatra that I like to associate with Holy Saturday, where after Antony dies in her arms, she just looks up and says, there has never been such a silence. And in many ways, that's what's happening on Holy Saturday. Jesus is in the tomb. He's to rise on Sunday. Creation is holding its breath and waiting. And there's that silence on a day of rest for the Jewish community. The Sabbath day is Saturday. And then Jesus rises on Sunday, which is celebrated as the Christian, not so much the Christian Sabbath as the Christian Day of the Lord, which is when we as Christians celebrate and worship on Sunday.
Phenomenal stuff, Father Bill. We really appreciate you coming by and breaking this down and explaining it to the audience. And I wish you in advance a very blessed Holy Week, and I will talk to you before then, but a happy Easter. And we appreciate you coming by.
Glad to be back.
Thanks, Father Bill. We'll talk soon. It's Father Bill Nicholas, getting ready for a very busy next few days.